Hello and welcome to Paradox Podcast, episode 52. 52! This one is entitled Drunk with Love. And our memory verse for this podcast is Song of Solomon, chapter 4, verse 5. And it reads this. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle that feed among the lilies. I feel like this verse is self-explanatory, so we can just close with prayer and call this episode good, right? No, if you're like me, you read this when you're in high school and you think to yourself, oh boy, he's talking about boobs. And as a 33-year-old with a Master's Divinity, I read this and there's a part of me still that says, oh, he's talking about boobs. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle that feed among the lilies. What on earth is this doing in the Holy Bible? We are in a series on Song of Solomon, and we have found that this is a very unique book within Scripture, mainly because it is written primarily from a black woman's perspective. She begins the book by saying, I am black and beautiful. And what we learned in the first part of this series is that part of the human journey is making peace with who God created us to be. Then a few verses later, she says these words, my beloved is mine and I am his. And while it's easy for a man to say something like that, we realize that this is a declaration of a new way of thinking about romantic relationships from a woman. And when she says, my beloved is mine and I am his, she reveals that love is as uncompromisingly selfish as it is recklessly selfless. And then in this third part, we come across this verse, your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle that feed among the lilies. And we say to ourselves, we can't possibly learn anything from this, can we? Well, we have to understand that this is part of a bigger chapter. And we're going to look at all of Song of Solomon, chapter 4, and we're going to begin in verse 1 and end in chapter 5, verse 1. Now, before we read it, there's a couple things that we need to talk about first. This chapter is filled with metaphors. These metaphors were not meant to be taken literally. So when this man says, your two breasts are like two fawns, he is not saying that her breasts are literally like two fawns. He is comparing them for metaphor because he's trying to describe what he is experiencing. It is possible for you to translate all of these metaphors correctly, but at the same time, you would completely miss the point. Because when we ask the question, what on earth is this verse doing in the Holy Bible? We have to remember that all of this here in Song of Solomon is poetry. Not only that, but it's poetry about sex. And chapter 4 is without a doubt the sexiest chapter in all of the Bible. Song of Solomon chapter 4 is about a man and a woman making love. And when they talk about it, they use a lot of metaphors. And you may be thinking to yourself, are they talking about that? The answer is probably. And when we talk about poetry and we talk about this poetry that is trying to describe sex, we have to remember also that this is translated poetry about sex. This was not written in English. And so if some of the metaphors seem dated or they seem wrong or they seem out of place, you have to remember that we are listening to translated poetry about sex written by two people who were probably farmers. And so the things that they're going to compare sex to are things that they understand. Just like when people write about sex today, they're writing about things that we can understand. So this poem exists to communicate what happens when two people make love. That's a really difficult thing to comprehend, let alone communicate to another human being. And so the people that are talking in this poem are using the vehicle of poetry because it's something more than just the biological function of reproduction. And when we talk about poetry, we must remember that poetry does not exist to be solved. Archibald MacLeish, I think, says it best from his poem, Ars Poetica, where he's talking about what poetry is. And in that poem, he says, a poem should not mean, but be. Now, at this point, all of the engineers are saying, this is a load of garbage. And I will tell you, your poem is usually pretty good when engineers are angry because engineers need answers. So we have to remember as we read Song of Solomon chapter 4 that this chapter doesn't exist to be solved. We're not here to figure out that this metaphor means that and that metaphor means that. And they're clearly talking about this act. No. we must remember as we read the Song of Solomon chapter 4 that poetry exists to be. So with that in mind, let's read together Song of Solomon chapter 4. The man begins to speak. He says, "How beautiful you are, my love. How very beautiful. Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats moving down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from the washing, all of which bear twins, and not one among them is bereaved. Your lips are like a crimson thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David built in courses. On it hang all 1,000 bucklers, all of them shields of warriors. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle that feed among the lilies. Until the day breeze and the shadows flee, I will hasten to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense. You are altogether beautiful, my love. There is no flaw in you. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Depart from the peak of Amana, from the peak of Senir and Hermon, from the dens of lions, from the mountains of leopards." And then he says to her, "You have ravished my heart, my sister, my bride." Now, at this point, you may stop and say, "My sister, what is happening here?" Well, sister was a term of endearment within Hebrew culture. And it's hard to believe that that was a term of sexual endearment, but it was. And the reason was because brothers and sisters were allowed to show public affection for one another when husband and wives were not. So there's this longing to refer to your lover as your sister or your brother because it says, "I want to show publicly how much I love you." But we are restricted because we are not brother and sister. We are husband and wife. Not only that, but you'll notice in verse 8 and then in verse 9, which we just read, the husband refers to this woman as his bride. Now, this is significant because this is the first time that he has referred to her as his bride. And so this is not insignificant because he's very clearly stating that some marriage happened somewhere, although it's not explicitly stated in Song of Solomon. But this woman is, in fact, his wife. So in verse 9, he says, "You have ravished my heart, my sister, my bride. You have ravished my heart with a glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How sweet is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your oils than any spice. Your lips distill nectar, my bride. Honey and milk are under your tongue. The scent of your garments is like the scent of Lebanon. A garden locked is my sister, my bride. A garden locked, a fountain sealed. Your channel is an orchard of pomegranates with all choicest fruits. Henna with nard, nard and saffron. Calamus and cinnamon with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes with all chief spices. A garden fountain, a well of living water, and flowing streams from Lebanon." The woman then responds to the man in verse 16. She says, "Awake, O north wind, and come, O south wind. Blow upon my garden, that its fragrance may be wafted abroad. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits." And then the man responds by saying, "I come to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gather my myrrh with my spice. I eat my honeycomb with my honey. I drink my wine with my milk." And then the woman, not speaking to the man, bids to all of us reading, "Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love." What a great ending to that chapter. When the woman says, "Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love," it's a bit jarring and a bit surprising because it's not often that drunk is used in a positive context. And in fact, when most people read this, and rarely do people read this in church, but when most people read this, they think to themselves, well, I mean, drunkenness usually has a negative connotation. Maybe that's not what she really meant. And if we look through the Bible, we say to ourselves, you know, we should look at what the Bible says about drunkenness before we put too much emphasis on what this woman says. For instance, if we look at 1 Peter 5:8, Peter writes, "Be sober and alert. Your enemy, the devil, like a roaring lion, is on the prowl looking for someone to devour." In Galatians 5, Paul writes, by contrast, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Proverbs 23, 19 to 21 says, do not spend time among drunkards, among those who eat too much meat, because drunkards and gluttons become impoverished and drowsiness clothes them with rags. So when this woman says, eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love, what she really means is, remember, everyone, it's important to keep everything in moderation. Except if this woman was alive with us today, I believe that she'd hear this idea that everything needs to be met with moderation. And she would stand up and say, that isn't what I said. And we would turn to this woman and say, well, what did you say? And she would say, I said, eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love. Now, at this point, you may say, well, let's look at the Hebrew, because maybe she didn't actually mean drunk. So if we were to look at the Hebrew word for what was translated as drunk, we would find the Hebrew word shakar. And if you look throughout the Old Testament, you realize that this word is used quite often, which is good because we usually can say with greater certainty what the word means. And you realize that it's most often translated as to be drunk. So when this woman says, eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love, a very good translation is, eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love. Now, this may sound unoriginal to you, because you can say to yourself, I've heard the phrase, be drunk with love somewhere, haven't I? And I would say, of course, but this woman came up with it originally, and Beyonce copied it with her song, Drunk in Love. Drunk in love, we'd be all night. Thing I remember is our beautiful bodies grinding off an igloo. Drunk in love. And so we have Beyonce saying the exact same thing that this woman is saying in Song of Solomon, which can only mean one thing. Drunk in Love is a biblical song. Now, at this point, you may say, I heard Craig Hadley was a heretic, and I knew he was a heretic, and now I have proof that he's a heretic. To say that Drunk in Love is a biblical song is one of the most ridiculous claims ever, and I would just simply ask you why. One objection might be, well, Song of Solomon is about a married couple. To which I would respond, well, Beyonce wrote Drunk in Love after she married Jay-Z. So Drunk in Love is about married people sex. And you could say, well, but Song of Solomon isn't sexually explicit. What Drunk in Love is, that's way too sexually explicit. To which I would respond, I just don't think you understand the metaphors of what happens in Song of Solomon chapter 4. To give you an idea, what Beyonce refers to as a surfboard in Drunk in Love, the author of Song of Solomon refers to as fruit. And what Song of Solomon refers to as a garden in the writings, Jay-Z refers to as cake in his rap in Drunk in Love. So they are both extremely sexually explicit. Now, someone might say, well, but Song of Solomon isn't as public or is in your face as Beyonce. To which I would say, do you realize how many copies of the Bible have been sold and produced? Yeah, Beyonce's album like sold 6 million copies or something ridiculous like that. But the Bible has been printed over a billion times. And so the arguments against Drunken Love being a biblical song actually attack Song of Solomon being in the Bible. Now, at this point, I need to give a big warning. And this warning is this. Do not look up Drunken Love by Beyonce unless you want a detailed description of how a baby is made. Like, that's what the song is about. Much like Song of Solomon chapter 4. But ultimately, Beyonce sings about what it means to fall head over heels into this passionate romance and desire for another, to be drunk in love. And thousands of years ago, another black woman says to all of us, eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love. These words are inspired, and they were written thousands of years ago, and I would even say they are 1,000 years ahead of its time. Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love. So what do these words mean for us today? I think they mean different things to us depending on where we are in life. And if we think about what life is, life is a series of stages, essentially. And there's this idea that you go through these different stages, and this phrase, eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love, means different things to you at different stages. So if you think about life, I can think of about 9 different stages that you go through in your life. The first stage is you're single, then you're dating, then you're engaged, then you're married, then your parents, then you're empty nesters, then your grandparents, then your great-grandparents, and then you're dead. I mean, that's really the 9 stages of life, right? And at each of these different stages, this verse means different things to different people. So let's start with the first stage. You're single. And what happens when we read these words, eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love? Now, at this point, a single person would raise an objection and say, this verse requires romance and I don't have a partner, so this doesn't apply to me. Well, I hear that. But I think that you need to understand what the definition of romance is. Because if you look up romance in the dictionary, the definition you get is a quality or feeling of mystery, excitement, and remoteness from everyday life. It says nothing about a partner. It says nothing about dating. It simply says a quality or feeling of mystery, excitement, and remoteness from everyday life. In other words, the dictionary will tell you that romance doesn't require a partner. Not only that, but if you look throughout history, you realize that there was a period of art and poetry that emerged in the Western world known as the Romantic period. What an interesting phrase to choose to describe a period of art. And if you look at what led up to the Romantic period, you realize that there was this industrial revolution in the Western world. And this industrial revolution happened, and there was an enlightenment that happened at about the same time. And what happened was there was this sense that people could explain everything, that they could explain how the world worked, and they could create machines to make people more efficient. And while that's all good, and I'm in support of the Industrial Revolution and of progress, surprisingly, I know, it's important for us to remember something here. People got so good at explaining that they felt like they could explain everything, including human beings. And so what happened was there was this squashing or this reduction of the human spirit and the human soul. And so artists responded to all of this by painting paintings reclaiming the human experience. And one of the most quintessential romantic paintings of the era was a painting by the German artist Caspar David Friedrich. And the painting's name is Wanderer Above the Sea and Fog. I'd highly recommend that you look it up. Caspar David Friedrich's painting, Wanderer Above the Sea and Fog. And in this painting, there's one man standing on a rock looking over a sea of fog. And he's just caught up in the mystery and the excitement and the remoteness from everyday life. And art historians would look at this painting and say, see, this painting is what a romantic painting is all about. And yet there's only one person in it. Romance doesn't require a partner. Romance requires an understanding and openness to what the mystery of life is. Richard Rohr, who is one of my favorite authors, is 74 years old, I believe. And he's a Catholic priest, and he's never been married because he's been a priest his entire adult life. And as he writes, he never once writes and says, oh man, I've missed out on so much because I never got married. You never get that sense that he feels like he missed out. He chose this life and he loves the life that he has. But when he talks about the love of God, he never says, you know, you need to be married to experience the full love of God. Instead, in his book, The Naked Now, he says, when you can be present, then you will know the real presence of God. In other words, he says, the most important thing for you to do is to learn how to be present and to live in the mystery of your own existence. And he says, you must learn how to be present so you can experience the presence of God. And then Richard Rohr later says, this is so simple to say and so hard to teach. When you can be present, you will know the real presence. So if you're single and you hear the phrase, eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love, it's important for us to remember that romance is not a partner. Romance is a posture in which you welcome the mystery of existence and the mystery of the real presence of God. And if we take Richard Rohr seriously, Richard Rohr would say you never need to move beyond the single stage to experience what it means to be drunk with love. Whether you are married or single or your grandparents, whatever stage of life you're in, I think we can all learn something from this because it's possible to be married and never be romantic. Romance is not a partner. Romance is a posture in which you are open to the mystery of your own existence. Now, let's talk about the second stage, the third stage, and the fourth stage all at the same time. You're dating, you're engaged, you're married. When we hear the words, eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love, there is a real temptation to read this text as eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with sex. I know that given the context of what Song of Solomon 4 was, it's real easy to read this as eat, friends, drink, and have a lot of sex. But that's not what this woman is saying. She is saying, eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love. And there is a major difference. To illustrate that difference, I want to talk about John F. Kennedy. Now, John F. Kennedy was speaking to a woman who was an author. And this author was interviewing John F. Kennedy about his parents. And she said, tell me what your dad was like. And he responded by saying, well, dad told all the boys to get laid as often as possible. And then he says, I can't go to sleep unless I've had a lay. In other words, JFK's dad said, whatever you do, just make sure that you have as much sex as you possibly can because that's the best that life has to offer. Into that context, this woman stands up and says, well, actually, there's something better. You can eat and you can drink and you can be drunk with love. But sex is not the measure of goodness when it comes to a romantic relationship. Song of Solomon, which is about the celebration of human sexuality, definitely talks about sex, but it doesn't make it the main point of a romantic relationship. In fact, I would say that Song of Solomon is about the goodness of romantic desire and passion. And so often we have this temptation to believe that healthy desire and healthy romantic passion is all tied up into the number of times you have sex. But that's not what this woman says. She says, you know what? Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love. And so there's a temptation to make your romantic relationship all about the number of times and the frequency with which you have sex. But Song of Solomon is saying, no. Make your relationship about romantic desire and passion. And whether you're dating, you're engaged, or you're married, Song of Solomon encourages you to not make your relationship about sex first and foremost. Song of Solomon encourages all of you in all stages of life to make your romantic relationships about desire and passion and celebrate that and enjoy it. Sex is a byproduct of romantic desire and passion. To all my brothers in Christ out there who are married and are wishing that they would have more sex within their marriage, I would encourage you to try and invest in the romantic desire and passion and put forth an enormous amount of effort in just being passionately in love with the woman you are married to, because sex is a byproduct of romantic desire and passion. Romantic desire and passion is not a byproduct of sex, where you have more sex and all of a sudden you get that desire and passion. It works the other way around. So at the very center of what your relationship should be is the celebration and the enjoyment of that desire and passion. I think that's something we can all learn, regardless of what stage you're in. Which brings us to the next stage, when you become parents. Now, Beyoncé recorded the song Drunken Love and put it on her self-titled album. And shortly after that album was released in December of 2013, she went on Good Morning America and did an interview. They asked her about this album, and they said, it's a strange album to release after you've become a parent. And she responded by saying, I was spending so much time being a mother, I would take a few hours out of the day and record. In real life, I was this woman, this mother, trying to get my focus and my dreams and myself back. Recording this album was a form of escape to create a world and fantasy that definitely at the time was not happening. She then looks right at the camera and says, "You can have your child and you can still have fun. You can still be sexy and you can still have dreams and still live for yourself." Now, I know what Beyoncé is talking about here because American society deems parenting to be mind-numbingly unsexy. Let me give you some examples. What happens when I say the words dad joke to you? No one thinks, "Oh, that's some great comedy." Everybody has this feeling that it's a joke that's not really funny, but we put up with it because dads and dads just aren't sexy. What happens when I say the words mom jeans? Nobody thinks of something sexy when they hear the word mom jeans. And the reason why is because American society deems parenting to be mind-numbingly unsexy. To give you another example, let's talk about the minivan. Now, the minivan is portrayed in several movies, and there's two movies in particular that I want to talk about. The first one is a movie called Bad Moms, and Bad Moms is not a Christian movie, in case you were confused. But in the movie Bad Moms, Mila Kunis drives around in a Chrysler Pacifica, and she drives, every time she drives it, she looks like a zombie. Like her life is just over, essentially. She's hauling the kids from soccer practice to school to everything in between, and she looks like she hates life. Then when she decides to reclaim her life, she ditches the minivan and gets a 1970 Dodge Challenger that's bright red, and she drives around and she's all of a sudden free. Her kids aren't strapped in. They're rolling around in the back seat. But hey, she's found her identity again once she ditched the minivan. Now, Bad Moms is not alone, and just one other example of a movie that does something similar to this is the movie Furious 7. In Furious 7, Paul Walker goes from driving a Subaru or something else into a minivan, and he goes and he picks up his kids from school, and he drops them off, and he's driving this minivan around town, and he's so bored as he's driving it that at one point he goes to Dom Toretto, and he says, "You know what I miss, Dom? I miss the bullets." In other words, Paul Walker would rather be shot at in Furious 7 than drive his kids around in a minivan. The minivan has become the cinematic symbol of a living death. Which is strange because when I found out that my wife was pregnant with our second kid, I immediately wanted to buy a minivan. Because, you know, we're a family of four, and this car is designed to accommodate a family of four. So it took some convincing, but my wife agreed that this would be the best car for us at this time. So we went to the Honda dealer, the Toyota dealer, and the Chrysler dealer because we were looking at three different models in particular. And we got to one of the dealers, and they saw us getting out of the car, and, you know, there's my wife who's pregnant. We have our daughter in her car seat. And they look and they say, "Oh, hey, what are you guys doing here?" Like, "Well, we need a new car." And they say, "Great, can I show you the Toyota Highlander?" And I say, "No, we want a minivan." And immediately the salesperson who's trying to sell me this car looks at me and says, "Why?" And I say to him, "Well, you know, we have a family of four." And he says, "Yeah, but you can look so much better in an SUV." And I said, "You know, I'd rather drive a minivan because of the sliding doors, which are amazing. They open themselves." And the man said, "All right." So we got in the minivan. We were driving it around. He was showing us some of the features. And we realized that he doesn't know many of the features. And I say, "Well, tell me about the different trim levels." And there's this long pause. And the salesman said, "Honestly, I don't know much about minivans." This man knew nothing about this car that he was trying to sell me. And so we went and looked at the Chrysler Pacifica next, and they had just redesigned the Chrysler Pacifica, and the dash has got like all of these screens and it lights up, and it's, you know, just, I feel like I'm driving a space shuttle when I'm driving a Chrysler Pacifica. And I turn to the salesman and I say, "Wow, this dash is really nice. They did a good job. I really like it." And the salesman, the person who's trying to sell me the car, mind you, says to me, "Yeah, it sure takes the sting out of driving a minivan." To which I'm like, "Do you want me to buy this? Like, I'm confused by this whole process." And so Kimmy and I decided that we were going to buy the Honda Odyssey, and we bought it. And there's a picture of us picking up our sarcophagus that Hollywood has told us will just instantly kill our souls. And we've had it now for a few months. And can I tell you what I've learned after driving a minivan for a few months? I love it. It is the greatest thing ever. And you may say why, and I'll tell you why. It is so easy to put our kids in the car, drive an hour down to Disneyland, and pull the kids out and have the greatest day ever at Disneyland as a family of four. And I love raising my kids. And yeah, there's times it's hard, and there's times that it's frightening, and there's times that I don't know what to do. But I have to tell you, when this woman writes, "Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love," I'm in this stage that people have told me is the unsexiest time of my life. And I found it to be incredibly filled with an overflowing abundance of love. And while people told me this would be a miserable stage, I think what this stage has taught me, and especially with these words from Song of Solomon 5, what I've learned is that romance never rushes. And when we talk about the different stages of life, yeah, there are ways that your life changes in relation to your romantic relationships and your kids. But the truth is, some people never get married and they are content there because they know that romance never rushes. There are people who get married, or there are people who become parents, and there are people who can't become parents, and yet they found peace with life because they know that romance never rushes. And there's this tendency to look at other stages and think that sexy, good times are at the other stages. But what the real trick is to learn how to be content with whatever stage you're in. And you don't play through these stages like they're a video game. You live through these stages and you savor and you enjoy each stage, because this woman thousands of years ago said, "Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love." Whether you're single, you're dating, you're engaged, you're married, your parents, your grandparents, whatever, eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love in whatever stage you are in. So being a parent has taught me that romance never rushes. And as much as people want to tell me that being a parent is mind-numbingly unsexy, I would just say, you are absolutely wrong. Which brings us to the sixth stage. When your kids move out and you become an empty nester, all I can say to you is one word: celebrate. Celebrate your achievements. Because my daughter just recently was potty trained, and it seemed impossible to me that she would one day get out of the house and go to college, because it was a challenge to have her potty trained. And yet there's this idea that people tell me that one day my daughter will go to college on her own, take classes on her own, and learn how to grow as a professional on her own. And I will tell you, that seems like the furthest thing from the truth right now. And so when your kids move out and go to college, there is this tendency to grieve what once was before. And it's important to grieve that. But ultimately, I think it's important to celebrate it, because you have come a long ways from where you started. And there are things that you can't do when you're a parent with kids in the house. And so I would encourage you to write those down before the kids move out. And as soon as they move out, start doing those things and celebrate and view this not as a time of grieving, but as a time for a party. So when this woman writes, "Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love," I would encourage empty nesters, and from us to all learn from empty nesters, that there is the importance of celebration. Which brings us to the seventh stage and the eighth stage of life, which is your grandparents, or you are great-grandparents. And when this woman writes, "Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love," I have to tell you that I think that seventh and eighth stagers, the grandparents and great-grandparents, do this verse better than anyone else on the list. Let me give you an example and a personal testimony. My mother-in-law, Ruth, is an amazing woman. And when she comes to visit, she gives Maya, my daughter, her full attention. Not only that, but Maya asks her to dance, and Ruth will dance with her. I'll dance with her, and then I have to drop out because I'm exhausted, and Maya will keep on dancing with Ruth, and she keeps dancing. Ruth continues to play piano with her. She'll continue to play dress-up dolls with her. And long after I have endurance to keep going, Ruth will continue to take care of my daughter and continue to show her love. From the time that Ruth shows up to the time she leaves, it is a nonstop party for my daughter because my daughter feels like she is the most important person on the planet. My mother-in-law is a fantastic grandmother, and I am so grateful for the way that she treats my daughter. Not only that, but my mother is just wonderful to my daughter as well. Both my wife and I work, and my mom watches my daughter one day a week while we are working, and my daughter looks forward to it every week. This is not like her going to childcare. This is like a day at Disneyland every week for her because my mom makes every day just this wonderful day, and it takes effort, and it takes energy, and it takes creativity, and it takes knowing who my daughter is. And my mom just gives and gives and gives in love because she loves my daughter so much. And this is the way grandparents are, right? And lastly, I think of my dad, who's an extremely busy man, extremely hardworking man. And by the time Friday night rolls around, I imagine that my dad is just insanely tired. He does so much for his work that he just, I would imagine at his age, he gets to the weekend and he just wants to just be done. But instead, what he does is he comes to my house every Saturday morning when I'm getting ready for church and I have to leave my wife because, you know, there's all this church work to do. My dad comes at 7 o'clock every morning and picks up my daughter and takes her to McDonald's and they have pancakes together every week. And my daughter loves it. She looks forward to it. She calls it pancakes with pops. And I know my dad's tired, but this is a priority to him. And he puts the effort in and he creates this time for my daughter. And what my mother-in-law and my mother and my dad teach me and what grandparents everywhere teach me is that when she says, eat friends, drink and be drunk with love, grandparents show us better than anyone that God created us to live in an overflowing excess of love. And we are to indulge ourselves in this love. We are to indulge ourselves in this beauty. And we are then to indulge ourselves some more. The reason I love these words so much, eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love. This woman is encouraging us to say, when you think you've had enough love in your life, give more and live in an overflowing excess of this love. My brothers, my sisters, whatever stage of life you are in, may you remember that romance is not a partner. It is a posture. May we remember that it's important to put at the center of our romantic relationships desire and passion and not sex. May we be reminded, as parents tell us, that romance never rushes and that there is no greater happiness in another stage. You can find the full fulfillment of Jesus Christ in any stage you are in. May we all remember that empty nesters have taught us the importance of celebration. And then may we remember that God has created us to live in an overflowing excess of love, similar to how grandparents treat their grandchildren. May you eat, my friends, and drink, and be drunk with love. Grace and peace to all of you.